Please be seated. Thank you for enduring the inconvenience of our short recess. The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Schmidt versus State. Counsel, each of you will have 15 minutes for your argument with an additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel for rebuttal if you choose to use that time. The timing limitations are reflected in the light and the clock and the lectern, which, by the way, you can raise or lower to your height at your convenience. There's a button right in front. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument, because we do keep track of these arguments in our audio recording of the proceedings. Counsel for appellant, you have the floor.
Good morning, Your Honors. Support staff, members of the audience. My name is Rory Patrick Durkin, and I represent the petitioner, Michael Frederick Schmidt, in this particular action. Your Honors, the Minnesota statutes provide for post-conviction relief. And we believe that we have met the requirements that would entitle us, or Mr. Schmidt, to a post-conviction hearing at the very least. And I think really that's what we're here for today. I don't think that we're here to talk about whether or not he would succeed and ultimately get a new trial, because really the order denied a hearing and we're appealing the decision to deny a hearing. I think that when the way that this normally, and I've done this many times, I would sit here and argue law, but I thought what I would do is I would kind of almost give you a picture of what happened with some of my time in this case. We received a correspondence from Mr. Schmidt that there was some newly discovered evidence in this case, and that newly discovered evidence would be an admission to the Spriegel offense that was, I claim, erroneously admitted at trial. So I did some research, I read the case law, and so now I'm battling two things. Number one, we have some newly discovered evidence regarding a Spriegel case, but in 2012, a panel of the Court of Appeals said that, you know what, so what? Even if this Spriegel evidence was admitted erroneously or it was improper, we don't need to address it, because it's no way that it would have affected the verdict at all. So now I got to do two things. Number one, is there really a recantation, or not even a recantation, but an admission to an offense that's worth anything? And number two, was the prior panel of the Court of Appeals correct? So we went out and hired an investigator, and the investigator interviewed Tracy Schmidt's mother, who stated that Tracy Schmidt admitted that she was the one that caused the harm in this Spriegel incident. Well, that's pretty significant when an individual claims that to her mother. Then we go interview her daughter, who says that my mom said that she is the one that caused the injury in the Spriegel offense. Okay, then we go interview Tracy Schmidt herself, who admits to causing the Spriegel offense because she was going to lose the ability to be a nurse.
She said she was unsure, right?
Well, she said a lot of things. She hemmed and hawed, and she was confronted and a little surprised and had dodged our investigator for quite some time. But ultimately, she admitted to, number one, failing a polygraph, and number two, acquiescing to the notion that she did cause those injuries because she failed a polygraph, and rather than waste my time, the transcript is what the transcript is of that conversation, and clearly she admitted to it. But you know what, Your Honor, you're right. Maybe it was a little bit doubtful. And the doubt that Judge Carter refers to in his order, and I think that he's touching on the Rainier factors, which I really think are not necessarily granting a trial on new Judge Carter basically is saying she's not entitled to a new trial because that information might be doubtful. what we weren't asking for a new trial, we were asking for a hearing. And at the very least, if there might have been some doubt in that evidence, that should have gone to, that's exactly what a post-conviction hearing is for. We could bring her in and we can get her testimony and we can subject her to the prosecution
No, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
That's okay. I'm used to it. I don't mind at all.
So my concern is, how is this newly discovered evidence? Certainly your client would have known at the time of trial who was responsible for the injuries to the child in 1994.
He did. And in fact, at a prior hearing where he's in an interview, he states, well, he was convicted of child endangerment. And that is the Spiegel evidence.
If you could speak from the, only because the microphone won't pick you up.
I'm sorry, you're right, totally right. He was convicted of child endangerment, no question, but for dropping the child, and no one looked, and that was where the confusion lied.
So you're saying the new evidence isn't the fact of what happened, it's the admission by the actual wrongdoer.
Well, there were two things.
Is that what you're saying is the new evidence?
The harm, at Mr. Schmidt's trial on this offense, there were brutal pictures of a bruised and battered penis. He did not cause those injuries. He dropped the child as he was carrying the child. Both Ms. Schmidt, who was Ms. Fox at the time, was both charged. Mr. Schmidt, as part of an ultimate deal, pled guilty to child endangerment, but only for dropping the child. And once again, that's what a post-conviction hearing would...
So I'm still lost on my question. If I could just focus you on that one question. What exactly is the new evidence?
The new evidence is that Tracy Schmidt caused the harm and injuries to the child.
Did your client know that at the time of trial?
He's always known that.
So how is that new?
Because it's not discovered, because it wasn't admitted to.
Well, that's what my question was. So you're saying, so that what the new evidence is her admission, not your client's knowledge about what happened.
Correct, absolutely. I mean, anybody that's wrongly convicted might know that he didn't do it and might know that he didn't cause those injuries, but until somebody is caught, for example, DNA evidence, right? Any rapist or murderer that's subsequently found free based on DNA evidence knows that they didn't do it and knows that they're not guilty of it, but until that DNA evidence is kicked in and popped into the system, much like a confession, right? Then that's the newly discovered evidence, not the knowledge that they didn't commit the particular offense. And maybe I misstated that. I don't know that he directly knew that she was the one that did it, but he knew that he didn't do it, and he suspected and surmised. And in fact, in an interview and in a letter from the Goodhue County attorney from several years ago, he even states and has even stated, Mr. Schmidt admits only to dropping the child. He did, however, state that there was a possibility that it was Mrs. Schmidt because of poor caretaking. And that was from the Goodhue County attorney, and that's part of the reason why he was allowed to plead guilty to child endangerment. But
I thought, am I correct that between the plea and the sentencing, way back, based on the injury to the young boy, I thought that somebody had written to the district court to say that it was Tracy who had caused the harm, not the not Mr. Schmidt. Didn't I get that somewhere from the record in this case?
And I just can't remember right now, and you may have, but then again, that's still not necessarily, and that might be a red herring, and it might even be, it might even weigh in and grant more support for the fact that Ms. Schmidt did in fact commit the harm to Tyler, which is what Mr. Schmidt all along has indicated, that he was convicted of child endangerment. He pled guilty to child endangerment for dropping the child, not causing the injuries that were based on the pictures that were shown to the jury at this later trial. That is newly discovered evidence without question. And once the jurors were polled and found, and nine were found, of the nine that were found, Two were sitting jurors. One was a juror that was an alternate. And those three jurors indicated and stated unequivocally that those, that prior Spriegel evidence, that prior offense, those pictures shown on the wall of that battered penis of an infant affected their decision to convict Mr. Schmidt of the offense.
Mr. Durkin, so the district court, I believe, or the post-conviction court, I should say, had two bases for denying the petition. First one, I think, goes to the merits of your newly discovered evidence claim. Second one has to do with the time bar, the two-year statute of limitations. In your appellant's, in your blue brief, you said that that was error because of the exceptions in 4B2, and then in the responsive brief, the state goes into detail on some of those, the five requirements in 4B2, one of which is that the evidence could not have been ascertained by the exercise of due diligence by the petitioner or the petitioner's attorney. That's the second one. And the fifth one is that the petitioner is innocent of the offense or offenses for which the petitioner was convicted. Seems like those are obstacles for you to overcome, right?
Well, no, I don't think that they're obstacles at all. I mean, look, there's, Your Honor, there's no question that Mr. Schmidt was convicted of child endangerment. He was convicted of child endangerment. However, the time bar doesn't affect or has nothing to do with newly discovered evidence. That's why there's the exception for newly discovered evidence.
Right, and I just read part of the statutory exception to the time bar.
Right,
is those things. I mean, for example, the last one. The petitioner has to establish by clear and convincing evidence that the petitioner is innocent of the offense or offenses for which the petitioner was convicted. I mean, if the newly discovered evidence goes only to the Spriegel incident, I don't see how that, even if true, let's just say even if that's true, I don't know how you've established that your client's innocent.
Well, I don't think that has to, that's what a hearing is for. Now, if the jurors...
But why have a hearing if the most that you could establish is that the Spriegel evidence is not proved, is inadmissible? But in order to get past the time bar...
If newly discovered evidence, Ms. Schmidt's confession to injuring the child, Tyler, back in 1994, was improperly admitted, and though hence the pictures and the images that were shown to the jury, and their horrible pictures. And if those images were not shown, and one juror says, you know what, if I didn't see those pictures, the case was flimsy, and I wouldn't have convicted. Well, then how have we not met our bar or our exception, and that's exactly what a hearing would be for.
So I think, to take that one step further, I think that there's a difference between the Rainier test and the statutory exception to the time bar. They're worded differently, and under the Rainier test, I think it's a lower standard, but under the statutory exception to the time bar, I think you have the burden of establishing by clear and convincing evidence that he's innocent. Not just that he might have gotten a not guilty verdict, but that he's innocent.
Well, isn't that the purpose of a hearing? And isn't the evidence, regardless, if there's any doubt, and any doubt should weigh in favor of the defendant and he should be granted a hearing. And at that hearing, whether or not there's clear and convincing evidence, I'm actually not sure how, I'm not exactly sure how to address that, if I can have just a second. And maybe I will address that on my rebuttal, if I may. Clearly, if there's any doubt, and if it's a close call with respect to Spriegel evidence, it shouldn't be admitted, number one. If there's newly discovered evidence in a criminal case, and it entitles, if there's newly discovered evidence, he should be granted an evidentiary hearing.
Let me and for the sake of your rebuttal, and that's fine, I'll draw your attention to page 6 of the red brief in the top part of the page. That's where the state makes that responsive argument. And so, in essence, my question is asking for your reply to that.
And I will answer that in my rebuttal. And that said, at this point, Your Honor, Your Honors, there is newly discovered evidence. It was obtained in good faith. It passes the Rainier factors, and it passes any other statutory test. And the district court abused his discretion when he refused to grant a post-conviction hearing. And many, if not all, of those questions could be addressed at a hearing, which was denied Mr. Schmidt. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Durkin. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning. My name is Heather Pipenhagen. I am an assistant Dakota County attorney, and I represent the state of Minnesota, who is the respondent in this case. We are here today because Mr. Schmidt, for the second time, is asking for a new trial based on the claim that there was Spriegel evidence admitted at his trial that should not have been admitted. The district court in this case, Judge Carter, summarily denied this post-conviction petition, and he should have. He should have because this petition is time-barred. Minnesota Statute 590 clearly states that a petition has to be brought within 2 years of when the judgment is final. This petition was brought 5.5 years after the conviction was final. The exception that Mr. Schmidt asked Judge Carter and is asking this court to apply to that time bar is the newly discovered evidence exception. But this is not newly discovered evidence. Newly discovered evidence has to meet the 5 criteria that are laid out in Minnesota Statute 590.01 Subdivision 4B. This was specifically already referenced by Justice Johnson, and he doesn't meet these 5 requirements. This is evidence that was known at the time of his trial. It was known at the time of the Spriegel hearing prior to the trial, at the time of the trial, at the time of his direct appeal, at the time of his previous post-conviction.
What was known? The fact that he didn't commit the Spriegel offense or the evidence that someone else did?
And that became very confusing today for the first time when I was listening to appellant's argument, because based on the submissions, the specific attachments to the post-conviction petition, and the statements from the witnesses, it was clear to me that the assertion was that he knowingly took the blame for Tracy Schmidt for these injuries, knowing he didn't commit them and she did because she was in nursing school. So that was the understanding I came into this argument on this morning. Now, listening to appellant's argument, it seems to have changed a little bit to, he wasn't really sure who did it, but he was just being a nice guy, and he took the blame for it. So I'm not really sure how that goes down, but he admitted to the offense at the time. And to say he only admitted to dropping the child, that's splitting hairs. Those charges that he pled guilty to.
But either way, even if he pleaded guilty to the offense, is it or is it not new evidence that there is a statement or that a witness has now taken the responsibility for it, another person has taken the responsibility for it?
I don't know, because I am not clear on what exactly appellant is saying at this point. He was charged with those injuries to the child. He pled guilty, it's my understanding, in connection to the injuries of those child. He may have just said, I dropped him, it was an accident. But I'm not aware that there's anything in the record that he was ever saying he didn't inflict those injuries. So it's my understanding he took responsibility for inflicting those injuries. I don't, and based on the submissions, it also seemed that he did it knowing she did it, and he didn't want her to have problems in nursing school. So that was my understanding. So to me, it's not newly discovered evidence. This was all things that the two of them both knew at the time that they made that agreement, that he would take responsibility for those injuries instead of her. I wasn't under the impression there was a misunderstanding about who caused the injuries.
Could you clarify for me? I asked Mr. Durkin a question about, didn't somebody write a letter to the district court at some point in the past? And one, is that familiar to you?
It is not, and I didn't go back and look in detail at the record from that other county on the Spriggle offense. I apologize. I did not look at that. So if that's in the record, I wouldn't disagree with it. I can't confirm it. But more importantly, it fails the newly discovered evidence test on the last prong, Justice Johnson, that you referred to. Whether or not it's newly discovered evidence, it does not establish by clear and convincing evidence his innocence of this offense. This isn't an attack on that prior conviction. He's asking for relief on this offense. So for it to be newly discovered evidence, however you construe that, either prior misunderstanding or him deliberately taking the blame for an injury, no matter what happened back then, that does nothing to establish by clear and convincing evidence that he is innocent of this assault against this child.
Can you respond to Mr. Durkin's argument that an evidentiary hearing might result in a juror saying, I would not have convicted, but for the Spriggle evidence, therefore he is asserting innocence because the result would be an acquittal. Can you respond to that?
I don't think you get to the hearing, because if the petition is time barred, you don't get to the hearing, and the petition has to establish actual innocence. All of his petition said is there were two jurors, only one of which even deliberated, that said, I considered the Spriggle.
But do you agree in principle with what his assertion is, which is that, let's assume the affidavit said exactly what he suggests a hearing would reveal, which is a juror would say, now, if I had known that he did not actually commit the Spriggle offense, I would not have voted to convict. Is that enough to show innocence?
I think that has to be asserted along with the petition.
No, but if it is that, I'm just trying to get a sense to conceptualize what innocence means. Is innocence evidence that he didn't commit the offense for which he was convicted in this case, or is innocence evidence that a jury would not have convicted him if the other evidence had been
under
presented?
The statute, it says innocence. The statute says he has to establish innocence. The Rainier test says would likely have produced an acquittal. The Rainer standard is a little bit different, but the statute says he has to produce facts that establish innocence. Nothing to do with that previous Spriggle offense impacts his innocence or guilt on this offense. And this is the one that he's filed the post-conviction petition on. He's not challenging that other conviction. He's challenging this conviction. So it's not newly discovered evidence that allows him to fall under that exception to the time bar. So Judge Carter was correct. This petition is time barred. This petition is also was NAFLA barred.
Did you argue that to the district court, NAFLA bar?
The attorney who did the appellate or did the post-conviction response did say it was NAFLA barred. She didn't do an analysis of NAFLA, but she did have a portion in her brief where she said it was NAFLA barred. She cited to NAFLA. There really wasn't any analysis that was flushed out, and I'm just going to speculate. I think she went into the time bar analysis after she referenced NAFLA, so she might have mixed the two up. But she did raise the NAFLA case in the memorandum in district court opposing the post-conviction petition. But obviously, based on my understanding of the facts, these were all things he knew at the time of his direct appeal and his previous post-conviction petition, but he didn't raise them.
And, of course, the district, again, post-conviction court did not decide the case based on NAFLA.
Nope, didn't even cite to NAFLA.
So, in a sense, you're urging us to affirm on alternative grounds.
Correct. I mean, Judge Carter referred to it as time barred. He didn't reference NAFLA. Ms. Natoli, like I said, she kind of made both arguments, but mixed them together a bit. I think the time bar issue stops it without even getting to NAFLA, but just as a for the sake of argument, these are things that could have been raised in the previous proceedings also, so that would be applicable. But even more importantly, even if he had filed, well, I won't say more importantly, the fact that it's untimely is probably the most important thing, but even if he had filed this petition in a timely manner, the evidence that he's raising doesn't satisfy the Rayner test, and a lot of this argument is repetitive on, of the newly discovered evidence argument because they're very similar standards. But even assuming arguendo, Mr. Schmidt did not inflict these injuries on this other child like he already admitted that he did, it would not be likely to produce an acquittal on this case at trial. And this exact court has already said as much. In his first appeal, in the direct appeal, he argued that the Spiegel evidence shouldn't have been admitted for a different reason in that case. But this court looked at it and said, we're not even going to bother to do that analysis because the evidence in this case on the instant offense was so strong. Even if it was wrongfully admitted, it was harmless error. So right there, I think this court's own opinion on that previous appeal tells you that the erroneous admission or lack of that admission at a different trial would not be likely to produce an acquittal. He has not demonstrated, and it's his burden in a post-conviction petition, that it had a significant effect on the verdict. All there was one deliberating juror that said, yeah, I considered the evidence. Well, jurors are supposed to consider all of the evidence that's presented to them at a trial. There was not a single juror that said, my verdict would have been different had I not heard that Spiegel evidence. That was not brought forward to support this petition. So he has not satisfied that it had a significant effect on the verdict. And again, this court's analysis already satisfied that issue in the first appeal. That analysis that the Spiegel being erroneously admitted would not have even mattered because the evidence was so strong, that doesn't change regardless of the argument as to why the Spiegel evidence was erroneously admitted. It's still the same argument, it's still the same analysis, and I would ask that the court reach the same conclusion in this case, find that the district court did not err when it summarily denied this petition that is time-barred and denied it on its merits. And if nobody has any other questions, I would forfeit the rest of my time.
Thank you. Rebuttal.
Yes, please,
Your Honor. And I will be brief once again. Good morning, Your Honors. Rory Durkin representing Mr. Schmidt, and I'm here for my 5 minutes of rebuttal. Very briefly, as far as the NAFLA bar that's discussed on page 7 of the red brief, as Judge Johnson calls it, a petition for post-conviction relief after a direct appeal has been completed may not be based on grounds that could have been raised on direct appeal of the conviction. Well, these are grounds that could not have been raised on appeal or direct appeal. That's why they're newly discovered evidence. Hence, there's no NAFLA time bar because they couldn't have been discovered. It was impossible. With respect to the time, 2-year time bar and the and last proviso, which is 5, unless he establishes by a clear and convincing standard that the petitioner is innocent of the offense for which the petitioner was convicted. Well, Your Honors, to me it seems as if a not guilty verdict is the same thing as establishing innocence.
How is that?
How is that? Because not guilty is not guilty.
Well, not guilty means the state has not met its burden of proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the elements of the charge. It doesn't mean that the individual actually is innocent. A person may be actually guilty, but not found guilty. So, I think there's a pretty clear distinction in the law between being found innocent and being found not guilty.
Not for purposes of raising a post-conviction relief, I mean, a petition for post-conviction relief. It seems to me...
Well, how does it establish his, that he actually did not do... Are you conceding that the newly discovered evidence, as you've defined it, would not establish your client's actual innocence, but it might establish that a jury would not convict him?
No, I don't. I'm not conceding that at all. I think it's very clear that a huge leg of the state's case was based upon this Spriegel.
Is there any case law that would support the merging of these concepts, actual innocence and the likelihood of a jury not convicting?
No, I am not aware of any. Not at this time, Your Honor. I am not. Frankly, it seems to me that if the primary reason that an individual was convicted because of illegal evidence that was presented before the jury, and it turns out later on that that damning evidence was improperly placed in front of a jury, that because it just seems to me that a 2-year bar because that evidence didn't prove that he was innocent versus it proves that he wouldn't have been convicted, it just doesn't seem to make sense to me. And, you know, perhaps I didn't research that part of my brief properly. You know, maybe I concede that. But it seems to me that to prevail, to at least, and you know what? Maybe I don't need to show that right now. Maybe that's why he should be granted an evidentiary hearing, because it doesn't necessarily state that I'm denied an evidentiary hearing because I can't prove that he was innocent. Maybe that's the purpose for my post-conviction hearing, to show maybe Tracy will come in and say, you know what? I caused that harm to Tyler in 1994. And gosh knows, we've watched enough lawyer movies when a witness might come and break and say, you know what? And I did this too to my other daughter. It's not impossible. And I don't think that the 2-year bar necessarily bars me from a hearing.
So you're suggesting you're suggesting that the confession of the Spriegel offense might lead to a confession of the underlying offense in this case?
It's entirely possible, and I think evidence that's borne out at a hearing lead to that.
Is there any circumstance in this case that would suggest that that will happen?
Yes, absolutely. And I read part of that, and that's in... There's a lot of that information throughout the entire record, and in fact, I think, you know, Judge Johnson touched on that in the letter that was written to the judge. There is evidence that would be borne out, and that's what a hearing is for.
Well, thank you. Your time has expired. Mr. Durkin, Ms. Pippenhagen, the matter is briefed and argued. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.